AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 246 for June 13th. Everything Camaro from A to Z28. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. I want to thank everybody for joining us right now. We've got Mark Stilo, the chief engineer for the Z28 Camaro and a Z28 in the studio with us. Later on in the show, we'll get to some of the news of the week. We're going to be talking about Ford having to recalculate its fuel economy. We've got Elon Musk saying he's going to give his patents away for free, and got some other things. I've been driving BMW M3s and M4 this week and test driving cars, and we'll get into that. But first, I got to say hello to my co-host, Gary Vasilash.
John, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
So the nose is improving for all those of you at home who are worrying. It's getting better. So
you have a smaller Band-Aid on your nose.
Week or two, it'll be back to normal. So just so you're wondering. But yeah, good to see you.
And then we have to welcome Michelle Krebs back here with us and with now AutoBytel. No, Auto Trader.
Yes.
Excuse me.
AutoTrader.com.
Okay. Yeah.
Senior analyst with AutoTrader.com.
Yeah.
14 days on the job. I know everything about it.
Wow.
Well, good. Then we brought the right person on with us today. But now we got to say hello to our guest, Mark Stilo. And it's awesome that you're here and brought one of your cars with you.
It's great to be here.
So you got a lot riding on your shoulders with this car, right? I mean, the Z28 is the uber most important part of the Camaro lineup of all times.
Yeah, it was great, though. You know, we were getting towards the end of the life cycle of Gen 5, and we did the ZL1, and that car was really, really good, but they were kind of holding the Z28 name back for a truly track-focused car. So Mark Royce really wanted to, you know, wanted a lighter weight car, a nimble car, and something that would really be a driver-focused type track car.
And like you said, very special. You're only making 500 of these?
We'll probably end up making, right now, we're about 3,000 over the, you know, over the 14 to 15 model year.
Okay. And
so what did you do to make this Z28 versus what you started with?
Well, the ZL1, you know, that car was moving along, and originally I was the lead development engineer on that car before GM kind of went through a bad time, went bankrupt. That project got canceled. So when it came back, they decided, Al Oppenheiser and Royce decided to call that a ZL1 and hold the Z28 name back for like a true road race style car. So the ZL1 did great. It really did well, but we had the Z28 back there. So we wanted to really optimize this track capability. So we needed a car that would go fast in the hard places. It needed to brake really well. It needed to corner really hard. And we wanted to have a naturally aspirated, lightweight, high-revving engine. So as we're going through trying to lightweight the car also, you know, we needed to improve its track performance. We wanted the carbon ceramic brakes for the braking capability and the mass reduction. We went to the smaller 19-inch wheel and tire package for the mass reduction, lower rotating inertia, all that kind of stuff. And it kind of just synthesized down to where we're at now.
What does the car weigh?
3820. So it's still, you know,
still kind of chunky.
It's still kind of chunky. It's a big car, you know. It is on the curve of lightweighting. The first pounds come pretty easy. Then it really hooks off. You know, the dollars per pound really start to come high as you get into it. So we struck a balance. We still, you know, we get rid of some stuff like all the sound deadening in the trunk. The car's only got one speaker and no air conditioning, and the AC's an option.
A true track car.
A true track
but
car.
But one speaker? Why has it even got one?
Well, for government regulations, the tick-tock for the turn signal comes through the speaker. So we had to keep the speaker for the turn signal indicator and some other MVMS requirements.
Yeah, everybody on the track needs to signal left going into the pits or right.
Right.
So, no, I mean, why do you even have turn signals?
Well, for all the safety. You know, it's still people.
It's a street car.
Yeah.
Street legal.
Many people will drive these and drive them back and forth to work. I mean, I've been driving one since February. You know, I had snow tires on it. Then I took the snow tires off and sitting out in the parking lot. So, I mean, it's a you can use it as a daily driver.
Is there a heater in it?
Oh, yeah. It's got...
But just no HVAC. I mean, no air conditioning.
The air conditioning's an option.
Okay.
And they threatened to take my man card away. I said, well, if somebody's getting AC, they should get the speakers, too. So, you know, so when you get the AC option, you also get the rest of the speakers in the car.
Well, you could give them earbuds.
Maybe you should look at one of those speakers that they have in greeting cards now that play little music. That'd be enough for the turn signal.
Yeah.
So let's talk about those brakes, because I've just recently experienced ceramic brakes, not on your car,
right.
But I was flabbergasted at the braking power that those things give you.
Yeah, I mean, at VIR or tracks like that, it'll pull like 1.5 G diesel. And it's just a really confidence-inspiring, you know, it's the power and the repeatability and consistency of the braking. The other thing we do with the braking system is, as you're cornering hard, you can get brake knockback, the pads can get pried back, and we sense that, and we tickle the ABS module to cinch the pads back up again. So the next time you go into a braking zone, the pedal is very consistent. So the braking, it just becomes addictive. We had a bunch of media down at Barber Motorsports Park down in Birmingham, Alabama, for the long lead press show, and all the riders, it took them a while just to get brake deeper, and pretty soon they'd come off the track and like, I could brake deeper yet, you know. So it just becomes very confidence inspiring.
I totally believe what you're saying. In fact, I would almost think that you need to take them out in the car with somebody who knows how deep you can take this into a turn, and show them. Look, it's no one's experienced brakes like this.
Right.
I mean, if you have not experienced ceramic brakes, you just cannot believe the braking power.
Oh, yeah. And but you got to be careful. Like, when we were doing events even internally, you got to walk people up from a ZL, you know, an SS to a ZL1 to a Z28, because if you do it the other way, they get used to the brakes.
They'll be in the weeds.
Yeah, they'll be in the weeds. So you only make that mistake a couple times.
Did you take this car to the Nürburgring?
Yes. I was fortunate enough to be one of the people that was over there. We had it over there twice. And we actually had it there in April last year and September. And it's an awesome track, and it's really rings the car out and shows you deficiencies that you can't find in North America.
Okay. So that leads to a question from one of our viewers. Chuck Grency wants to know, how much faster was the Z28 around it than the ZL1?
The Z28 ran 737 and change. And the ZL1 was a 741. So, and the video that we official posted, it rained like the last quarter of the lap. I don't know if you've seen the YouTube video or not, but Adam Dean was driving, and it's really epic. It's very cool, and he's very committed on the lap. And we were testing over there, and to get a lap time during industry pool time at the Nürburgring, you've got a small window between 4 and 4:15 to do it. Because you can't video why other cars are on the track for obvious reasons. And if you rent the track in the morning, it's usually too cold or wet. So you got like this short window between the industry pool time and public time. And every day it would be like sunny and the track so long, by the time you get somewhere, it starts raining.
That's right.
So for 2 weeks, yeah, it was doing that.
It's 14 miles?
A little over 12 miles.
12 miles? Okay.
And 1,000-foot elevation change.
Man, I've driven the track, although it's been quite a while since I've done it, but... You're right. All the bends and twists and ups and downs, I could see where it'd tweak a chassis every way you can possibly do it.
Right.
But didn't you guys do at the Milford Proving Grounds, the Lutz ring that sort of mimicked part of the Nürburgring track, the Nordschleife?
Oh, yeah. We're there all the time doing development work. The car had, hundreds of laps there, sorting and tuning and, going through tire submissions and chassis tuning and stuff like that. So that's our home track. That's what we do all of our development work.
But it's not the same as going to Germany?
No, if you run there in VIR and a couple of, those two tracks mainly here in the North America, it really sets you up well to go over there. So those two tracks together kind of get the essence of what the Nürburgring is.
What's your time?
I ran a 45, 7:45.
Okay, that's Holland.
And I actually rode...
Anything under 8 minutes, right, is a good time.
Yeah, and we were running some laps with Al Oppenheiser, the chief engineer in the car. We were running in the 40s, and we were honking along pretty good.
So tell us about the powertrain.
The powertrain is the Corvette, the old Corvette Z06 engine, the LS7. We took that engine. It's very, very well proven. It's one of the highest power density engines we have. So we had to modify the induction. It's got a really big open inlet to get the inlet dispersion we need to make 500 horsepower. And then we had to redo the exhaust on the car to get a nice free-flowing exhaust to maintain the 500 horsepower also. Mm-hmm. It's actually got 2 3/4-inch pipes all the way out the back.
But you talked earlier about making it a free revving engine.
Right.
Did you make any changes to it in that regard?
No, it was a validated engine. So powertrain, we had a little bit of a battle to keep it into production. It actually was hand-assembled at Wixom, and now it's hand-assembled down in Bowling Green, Kentucky, mm-hmm. at the build center down there.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it important to do these kind of cars?
I think these cars are halo cars. I mean, these kind of cars are the kind of cars that where you get 2 13-year-old boys arguing about who's got the fastest car out in the playground. You know, these are the kind of cars that are just emotional cars that people really gravitate towards. I mean, driving the early cars down the highway, you got people pulling them next to you, and they're giving you the thumbs up and stuff like that. So they're just iconic cars that people like to read about, and they like reading about shootouts. And it's this great rivalry between us, you know, and the Mustang guys. And it's that.
So how does it do against the Mustang guy? I read a great quote you gave.
Early on, we were like making sure we wanted it to be faster than the Ford offerings. And then pretty soon we're like, we just got to benchmark against ourselves. And I think the thing that I was really proud of is when we put out a challenge at the Barber Motorsports Park to the media, bring any car you want to bring and we'll run you. Run what you brought. Nobody brought a Mustang. You know, they brought GT3s. They brought 911 turbos. They brought, you know, everything. You know, they brought in the Nissan GTR. So those are the kind of cars they brought to run against our car. Hot Rod did bring up a souped-up Boss 302. But it was a non-event. So,
but this is what a $70,000 car.
Yeah, $75,000 car.
So bringing a GTR is not too unfair. No. A GT3, yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
But but price wise, that some of those cars are not too far out of line.
No, you know, and this car is, you know, it's not cheap, you know. But there's the componentry on it is very high end. Everything on it, you know, you got Recaro seats, you got, you know, the Brembo carbon ceramic brakes, you got Pankel titanium connecting rods in the engine. So everything is very, very tuned, and you know, all the boutique-y kind of parts are there to go that fast.
And I got to believe there's Camaro people who they're not interested in a vet. Is that right?
Yeah, there's definitely a demographic where there's like, you know, Camaro people and Corvette people. I actually talked to a guy, he bought two. You know, he bought two Z28s. He's a Camaro guy, and he bought two of them. He thought they were so cool. So it's like, okay, that's great.
So did you work with the people who own Z28s in terms of developing this car? I mean, did you go out there and say, you know, what are you guys looking for? What can we provide you with?
No, I mean, when this project came along, you know, the benchmark to me was the ZL1 was such an awesome car. I was like, how am I going to outrun the car, that, you know, Aaron Link's timer on the Nürburgring of his 742, we're all just standing around going, holy crap, that's really fast. You know, because the last car we had there with the same kind of engine was the CTSV, and we ran a 759. We thought that was epic. And here we crushed that down way far down into the time frame. And so we started doing a lot of the computer simulations at work and lap sim, and we're trying to figure out exactly how much grip we needed. You know, because some things were fixed, you know. It was fixed on power, but we knew we needed more downforce to get more cornering speed. So a lot of it was done analytically before we built the first car.
How good were your simulations? Did you still get knocked out when you went to the track and do better than what the sim said?
We were really close. We actually outran the simulations at the Milford Road Course just to, you know, we had some VTS, vehicle technical specifications, on how fast we wanted the car. Once we hit that, we just kept on going. We just kept on making the car faster.
Hmm.
So, and that's the cool thing about the team that I've been working with for the last couple of years is they're all racers. They all really are passionate about doing the best car we can. So even though we met our requirements, our VTS were fulfilled, we just kept on pushing it.
So you're the ultimate Camaro guy from everything I've read. What is it, how many have you owned, and why Camaros? Why are you so madly in love with them?
I've had 15 first gens, and they're the right wheelbase. They're the right size car. I like that size car. And when I first came to Detroit in 88, I worked on F-Car Showroom Stock Racing, Camaro, Firebird, Showroom mm-hmm. Stock Racing with Heinerse. So I've been with Camaros forever. I mean, my first summer internship project was I put the first 1LEs into production. So my summer project in 1988 was I hand-built the first I think we built eight of them that year. So I've been with Camaro for a long time.
So were you one of those 13-year-olds way back when arguing in the playground over which was the fastest?
The funny thing is my dad was a Ford guy and I was a Mustang guy. And I got my...
Oh, you're going to hell, man.
I know.
There's no redemption.
No, there was redemption because he's gone to the seen the light, apparently.
Yeah. So it's like, so when I was in college, I wanted to work for the big three, and Ford wasn't on campus, and I interviewed with Chuck Hughes, who was the chief engineer at Camaro at the time, and he and I became fast friends, and I was friends with him until he passed away, so he was a great guy.
You know, I like what you're saying about doing a halo car, because you're right. I was one of those 13-year-olds. I was a Ford guy, though. My dad was, so. But it's true. You do a car like this, it may not pay off for the company, in some instances, for another 30 years. But you'll have somebody who says, you know, when I was a kid, I always wanted a Camaro. Now there's going to be the 2040 Camaro that they're going to go out and buy. But it's interesting that these kinds of cars can pay dividends for a company long after they're out of production.
Right. I mean, I was at an event and ran into a younger kid, and he knew every cover the car was on. He had read every article, you know, and it's just, it really permeates that culture, you know.
Mm-hmm. So you're mentioning that when the company went through its financial problems, that there was a red light for vehicle development. So one of our viewers, JM1NB, was wondering, is there something that was on the wish list once you got the green light for this car that you just didn't get?
This car, it was pretty open. I didn't get to do quite as much tire development as I wanted to because the time frame was pretty short, but we got pretty much what we wanted to do. You know, it was, we had a mission, we hit it, and we had an early development vehicle we built, and that car was, you know. And the other thing is, like, we had been working with the Zeta platform long enough, and we learned a lot on ZL1, 1LE, that we got ready to do this car. The team was mature, and we kind of knew what we wanted to do. And we got pretty much everything we wanted.
That's great. So, we've got a couple of other questions around here. Where did I see that one? You talked about lightweighting earlier, and everyone's talking aluminum these days. Any thoughts to that?
Well, like with the already tooled car, it's hard to go back and, you know, and redo a lot of the black iron and stuff that's like, you know, just, I mean, like we were going to do a carbon fiber hood, but the hood's already aluminum. You know, you're like, it's harder to make it lighter than it already is. So, that, you know, it's a point in diminishing returns unless you really have the opportunity like the C7 Corvette where they really went in and lightweighted the car from a clean sheet of paper. So when you're taking a carryover architecture, you know, and doing a performance variant off an existing platform, it gets really expensive when you want to start changing big stuff.
Right. So it's basically subtractive more than anything else in terms of this. You didn't talk about the transmission for this car.
It's a TR6060. You know, those have been around for a long time. We use the gear ratios were the same as a 1LE with the 391 rear axle. It really... The engine power band and that particular box with a 2.66 first gear ratio with a tighter 1-through-4 spread really works well on the track. We had the cars at Gingerman yesterday and driving it, and I was like, wow, the gear ratios are really nice for Gingerman.
Yeah. So Sean from our shop here was at Gingerman.
Okay.
And he loved the car, but he thought that the shift linkage for third gears, he said he missed third a couple of times, thought that it was the gear shift's problem, not his.
I think he might not have just... I've never missed it.
I'll let Sean know about that.
Operator error.
Yeah.
And sometimes, to handle the torque that these engines make, the gearbox is a pretty stout piece. It's not like some of the Japanese cars with a really short throw shifter. It feels really good. It's nice and direct, but... You know, you need to get the shift done.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of the transmission, Aaron wants to know whether the new GM 8-speed would fit.
8-speed automatic?
Yeah.
The tunnel, I don't think so.
No.
There's no intentions of putting it in that architecture.
These are only manual transmission cars.
These are manual only. You know, the only option.
Ergo, it's a track car. Really.
You got you can pick one of five colors, AC or no AC, and that's it.
Wow.
That's it.
That's great. It really is. So here, James Welling wants to know, what about a right-hand drive Camaro for the UK? Cheers, he says. That's not your call.
Yeah, it's not my call. And I've actually talked to some of the guys in Australia, and there's upfitters that spend, they do a good job of mirroring the dash and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So there's actually upfitters in Australia that make them right-hand drive. Mm-hmm. They're very expensive, is what I've heard.
So, would there be issues in terms of the linkage of the steering?
Well, because the car is architected in Australia, a lot of that stuff is pretty easy to move it to a right-hand drive. So I became friends with a lot of the Holden guys as we were doing Zeta, these Camaro development.
And if you sort of bake that into the design from the get-go, it does make right or left-hand steer conversions a lot easier.
Yeah, but we never tooled up any of the parts to do that.
Mm-hmm. What about, I thought I saw another question in here, too. What about all-wheel drive? That would be a major overhaul.
That'd be overhaul, but you might be able to go into the Zeta parts bin and I was talking to one of the Zeta guys, and it wouldn't be that far-fetched to make a Camaro all-wheel drive.
Wow, and keep the same engine?
The oil pan would be different, so I haven't laid it out. I don't know how hard it would be. If there's a will, there's a way.
Yeah, I like what you're saying.
He's given it thought.
Sorry, Michelle.
And he's given it thought.
Yeah. Hey, we got a phone call here, too. Ben, let's bring that phoner in.
Hi, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. Just one of the panel thoughts. Is there any chance that we could see all-wheel drive as an option on the next-generation Camaro? Since our car is going to be based on the Alpha architecture anyway, I don't think it would be technically that difficult. And living in the snow belt, that would be awesome. Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, and stupid me, just sort of stomped all over his question. But, yeah, for the winter, too, although you said you were driving it in the winter with snow tires.
Yeah, we put Blizzaks on the ZL1s and the SSs, and, I drove my car. This winter was terrible. And I had Blizzaks on my Z28. I drove it every day.
Okay, but how long have you been driving Camaros?
A while.
Yeah, so for most civilians getting in, the winter we've had with such a powerful rear drive car, that would be...
I would not flip the keys to my mom. So.
But it's amazing the difference. We've talked about this on the show. Snow tires are transformational.
Snow tires are just magic.
Especially those Blizzaks.
Oh yeah, the Blizzaks, they work really, really good.
Yeah, I've often said if I had a choice between snow tires and all wheel drive for driving in the snow, my first choice is the snow tires.
Oh yeah. Because when you fly to Europe, that's how they do it.
Mm-hmm. And, Michelle was mentioning what a Camaro guy you are. We got to talk about this book that you've got here that you've written called Pro Touring, Engineered Performance, Mark Stilo. So tell us a little bit about this book.
Well, back in 1993, I started building a 69 Camaro and doing road race type stuff. So it was to do Car and Driver One Lap of America. And it started this genre called pro touring, where you take an old car, you put all the modern drive on it, and update the suspension so you can road race it and do other things like that. So over the years, I've been fortunate. I've done a number of project cars and have been featured in some magazines where that term has kind of turned into a build style, where people build that kind of car to do those type of events. So when I built this car back in 2003... I kind of chronologized. We had a bunch of pictures, so we just put it all in a book.
And how many pictures?
It was like 1,183.
1,183.
Yeah, sort of about.
So you really documented very well everything that you did with this car.
Right. And it was like a 22 consecutive part buildup in Popular Hot Rodding magazine. And it was just, so I just had all this stuff. So we just put it in a book.
So this is basically... contemporary technology put in an old package?
Yeah, like my current car has got an LS9 with ABS brakes and, modified suspension. It's got carbon ceramic brakes on it and everything else like that. So I like to take that old aesthetic and that the way those cars are, but I want to modernize them with new drive lines and redoing the suspension geometry so I can take them to track events and compete with them.
So could you put a 69 body on this chassis?
You could. I think there's people that have done it.
Really?
Yeah.
So that would be a pro touring vehicle?
It could be. It's a loose definition. Mainly people are taking older Camaros, Chevelles, Novas, or Mustangs or whatever, and they're putting bigger tires and wheels and bigger brakes and usually fuel-injected motors that have much better drivability and overdrive transmissions that allow them to drive, because those cars, original big block 396 Camaro with a 4-speed and 411 gears is kind of miserable to drive around. But if you kind of put an overdrive transmission in it and air conditioning, it's it's much easier to take It's much easier to take your wife to A&W.
Yeah.
You know, it's
like. So back to the book for a minute. You were kind enough to bring three of them here, so we're going to be giving them away. We'll have to figure out how to do that just yet. But for those unlucky enough not to have us give them one, where else can they find it?
Oh, I've got a website, markstilo.com, where I sell them, or you can get them from Detroit Speed and Engineering's website.
Okay, good. Good to know. So everyone's saying, wow, Mark, what a great job. What's next?
I'm back to Milford Proving Grounds. I'm working in advanced vehicle dynamics. Again, it's fun to play with future technologies and look at, you know, defining the architectures of future things going on at GM. So I think that's I've been very fortunate to kind of blend my personal passions and my work life. It becomes kind of a gray zone between the two. So both are mutually beneficial.
It's the best way to go to work.
Yeah.
Can't wait till you get there.
Yeah.
That's really cool. You know, I got to thank you for having come here. Do we have any more questions there, Gary?
Here's one you may know since you're at the Proving Ground. Blake Keithley wants to know, will the Z28 beat an Alpha 4C on a track?
There was one at the Nürburgring when we were there. Depends on the venue. You know, I think at the ring, I don't remember the lap time it ran because they were kind of still testing. So I can't answer that question. They were very fast, so we could catch them in the straightaways, and they were pretty quick car. So I haven't seen lap times on the car yet.
So what do you think?
I think it'd be pretty close.
Yeah.
Scott V wants to know: can you compare and contrast the Z28's naturally aspirated V8 to the ZL1's supercharged V8 when it comes to racetrack capability?
The ZL1 has a more dynamic range, you know, so it's got low end torque and higher horsepower, and I can kind of consider in general the ZL1's more of a bimodal kind of car where you can drive it on the street with the MR shocks and take it to the drag strip and take it to the track, but the Z28 will ultimately put down faster lap times on the road course. It's not going to be that multi-purpose kind of a car. The ZL1's kind of a multi-purpose car where it does a lot of things well. This car does one thing exceptionally well.
Scott V also wants to know, do you find the supercharged V8 to be less resistant to heat soak for a long day at the track?
The ZL1 is more, it puts out a lot more, because you're cooling the engine and the intercooler and everything, so the ZL1 puts out a lot more heat. So the NA cars typically hold up a little bit better at higher ambience.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. And then finally, he says, what features of the Z28 engine made it the ultimate choice for this application?
Just the 7,000 RPM redline and the power density engine. You know, it's 505 horsepower. And you look at, you lay a dual overhead cam Coyote motor on the ground next to a LS7, and a Coyote motor is huge and it's very heavy. But it's 5 liters, and this is 7 liters. So people say, well, that's a bigger motor. Well, that's a lighter motor that's smaller external package, but makes more power density. So, you know, people kind of badmouth pushrod engines, but they're actually an elegant design, in my opinion.
Yeah. Wright Knight wants to know, why not do a 427SS version positioned between the ZL1 and Z28?
They're talking about the Chev SS? Or the Camaro SS.
Camaro SS, I think.
Not really sure the question. He wants to do what?
Well, there is a Camaro SS.
We got a Camaro SS.
I've got one out. Drove one over today. And speaking of people looking at the car, I was going through a subdivision. The guy in a pickup truck was so fascinated by the car, I thought he was going to hit me.
Well, what he's saying is the LS7 would make a wonderful option for the SS.
You know, you get into such part proliferation and stuff like that. We got SSs, we got 1LEs, we got ZL1s and Z28s. I think that hopefully make 90% of the people happy.
Yeah. That's a good way to look at it. Well, let's see. We've got another one here that says the Z06 uses an air cooler. The ZR1 uses a coolant/oil heat exchanger. The Z28 uses a combination of both coolant/oil heat exchanger and an oil cooler. What advantages/disadvantages to each approach, and why did you use the everything approach on the Z?
Well, we wanted to go after oil cooling because I wanted to be able to have the, We run a 24-hour endurance test. We don't do it consecutive 24 hours, but we run the car on track for 24 hours to make sure it's durable. And part of that is the thermal test. And we wanted to get the oil temperatures under control. So we actually take engine coolant, come out of the block, go through the first exchanger, and bring that chilled water back to the oil cooler to keep the oil temperatures under control. And part of the reason we did it that way, instead of piping the oil out and back, is you have less oil pressure loss, and it's more durable for the engine to keep the oil passages short and find. And also doing it that way, you can kind of use that coolant when you first fire it up will kind of preheat the oil. So when you go on track, the oil temperatures are more under control.
And this is truly a track car, so there's no such thing as too much cooling, I think.
No, we threw as much cooling as we could get in it, and we actually went as far as, we hollowed out the center of the bow tie to get as much airflow through the car. I don't know if you noticed, the grille is very wispy. We made it as thin as possible to get as much airflow through it, and the hood extractor and all those pieces are just to try to keep the car as cool as possible.
I love the fact that you brought up the Chevy bow tie logo is hollowed out, just sort of the outline edge. About the time that you got to GM, Chevrolet Performance had even lapel pins that were
red.
Just sort of the red ones. Right. I've got one, as a matter of fact. And to me, that sort of harkens back to that performance bow tie.
Right. And the victory circle hats were the red bow tie. If you won, you got the red bow tie hat.
Right. Very cool. Well, with that, Mark, thanks so much for coming on.
It was a pleasure.
After hours, bringing a Z28 along with you. We'll make sure that we get these books in the hands of true Z28 fanatics. So really terrific having you here.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Mark.
Good to meet you.
Good. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be coming back to talk about news, and we're going to be doing some rapid fire of a different sort.
A car company that's never made a single car. Legendary durability. Impressive mileage. Firestone tires. So unstrap the saddle. These old stallions are ready to run. Again. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
You already know that you can listen to Autoline's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to Autoline.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play just like you would on your computer.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from Autoline's top-notch insider information with Autoline on the go. Boy, you got to love Mark Stilo. That guy is totally into what he's doing.
Sure is.
I love meeting people like that who love their jobs. Yeah. I mean, who might just do this even if you didn't pay them.
Well, given all those Camaros that he's built over the years.
He is Mr. Camaro.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, and so he gets paid to do that?
He's a focus group of one.
Yeah, how great is
that? He has a car show. I researched him. He does a car show on his front lawn every year.
I earlier this week got a chance to drive the BMW M3 and M4 at Road America, and they had the optional ceramic brakes on there, and that's my first experience in driving ceramic brakes on a track, a high-speed track with heavy-duty braking zones, and you could just beat these things, beat them, then no fade whatsoever. And I'm a convert. I'm astonished at how good they
are. Have you checked the price when you have to replace? When you have to replace those, I think that your conversion may—you may be a lapsed convert at some point. I got to believe
that
the
option is like $3,000 or $4,000 or something like that. So. But, if you're going for the ultimate in performance, it's astonishing how well they work.
So, it was interesting, when Michelle asked why do these cars, and, I thought that was a pretty good answer of the 13-year-old kids talking about, whether it's a Mustang or a Challenger or a Camaro. So why does BMW do those M cars? Do the little kids in Germany sit around in...
Well, yeah, I think so. And, well, there's a couple of reasons, too. Number one is it is the ultimate driving machine, right? Then you got to keep stepping it up. And it's very interesting because BMW had brought prior generations of M3s. We weren't able to drive them, but it was kind of cool looking at them. And so the original M3 is almost 30 years old right now. And when you look at that car, which when it came out, we all went, woohoo, look at this thing, so much fun to drive, what a blast, it's quick, it's this and that and the other thing. The new one makes it look like a little Econo box, nothing. And so that got me thinking, 30 years from now, are we going to look back on the current M4 and M3 and go, you know, I remember when we thought those were fast, because they're blindingly quick. And you just got to wonder, where does performance go from here? When you've got... Corvettes with 650 horsepower, 650 pound-feet of torque. I mean, it's how much faster... And I know there's other cars out there, Bugattis with 1,000 horsepower.
But at some point, you reach a limit, I would think.
I wonder, do you? I wonder. You know,
in the blink of an eye.
Yeah.
But also the other reason they do them, and maybe not the Z28, but as we were talking about earlier, is there's a good profit margin for the manufacturer in those. You know, put some extra equipment and jack up the price.
Mm-hmm. Sure you can. I say you put in $5,000 more of equipment and you charge $30,000 more for the car and people line up to buy them.
But, you know, John, to your point, so you're looking at the 30-year-old car and you're looking at the new car. So is it that you're saying, gee, this looks sort of pokey, the old one, and the new one just looks so...
No, the original one... It looks a little bit dated, but it doesn't look horribly dated. It's just the performance levels are stunning, stunning. I mean, it's so much faster, corners so much quicker, brakes so much in shorter distance.
But look at the advancements in ceramic brakes and electronics, all the advancements we've made.
Right, and so I'm saying, we're going, wow, look at this 2015 model. Mm-hmm. 30 years from now, where are we going to be? Because
we'll just be poking along at 25 miles an hour, and somebody will go by at 30, and we'll go, holy shit, look at that.
Right.
Or the forever promised flying car, you know?
Yeah, well, there was a report today that Toyota's looking at hover cars, and I got to learn more about it before we dive into that. What we should dive into is Ford Motor Company had to have an emergency conference today to reduce the fuel economy of, what, about a half a dozen models?
Yeah.
Right. They called us about 15 minutes before and said, be on the line. And, a little glitch in their computer modeling, it appears, or something to that effect.
But, Michelle, this isn't the first time.
No, it is not.
They had to reduce the C-Max hybrid. And
last year.
Exactly.
It was just the C-Max, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
And they went from 47 miles per gallon to 43, and now they've lowered it yet again to 40.
Right.
I mean, didn't you catch this a year ago?
Right.
What's going on?
Yeah, so last year is 8.5% reduction in what they claimed. I'm just wondering, you remember when the C-Max was coming out and they were making such a big deal out about it versus the Prius V and how much more fuel efficient it was? And so I checked the EPA website today, and the Prius V is actually more fuel efficient than the C-Max with the revised numbers. And, they revised those down.
I still don't believe the numbers they're publishing, because in my real-world testing, I got a consistent 37 miles per gallon in the C-Max hybrid, and the Fusion hybrid, for that matter, too. Mm-hmm.
Well, the Fusion hybrid numbers really went down considerably, because, I mean, they had been 47, 47, 47, and the revised numbers are 44, 41, 42 combined.
I'd feel much more comfortable if the number was 37. I'm telling you,
The MKZ hybrid, speaking of 37, it's 38, 37, 38. So there you go. You get a 37.
So the question I got asked by a lot of media today is, will this hurt sales? Now, the C-Max isn't doing that great anyway, but...
Yeah, they do 3,000 a month, maybe, something like that.
They're way off from last year.
But here's my question. I think Hyundai did get dinged in sales 2 years ago when
they had to go out and resell it.
So why wouldn't Ford get dinged in sales?
Well, I think what we saw is that Hyundai, Kia, kind of the people lost interest because they didn't have a lot of new product on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Ford brand is strong enough to withstand it. Now, you know, the sales, clearly sales of the C-Max aren't that strong. I just don't think it's going to hurt them overall.
I think it'll hurt their hybrids, though.
Yep. So what was the number of sales that the Hyundai Kia cars, I mean, how many were affected? Because in the case of Ford, it's 200,000 cars that are on the market that they're going to have to pay.
Yeah, wasn't the Hyundai Kia thing across the board? Was it all the models?
I can't remember.
I don't remember now either.
Right. Yeah. But, I mean, that's a pretty good chunk of cars, 200,000.
You know, when owners get a check in the mail, I have a sister who owns a C-Max. She got a check, you know, kind of.
She's happy. She doesn't
She's going to get another check.
Sent her an email and said, you're getting another check.
She's going to be happy.
She's
like the best car she ever bought. They just keep sending her money.
Well, plus, people don't buy hybrids just because it's that certain, you know, I'm going to get the highest mileage. There is an image they want to portray that, or this, they're of this consciousness that they think they're doing something environmental. And probably it's getting a lot better fuel economy than they had before, with sure. whatever they were driving before.
Undoubtedly, almost undoubtedly, mm-hmm. right. Speaking of plug-in hybrids, I drove a Cadillac ELR this week for the first time. At first, it didn't do that much for me, but the more I drove the car, the more I came to like it. First off, the styling is
so pretty.
Interior, exceptionally good. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I came to love is the paddles on the steering wheel mm-hmm. are not for downshifting. They activate the regenerative braking.
Oh, interesting.
And it is so slowing down of the car that I got into trying never to touch the brake pedal. And so unless you came to a stop sign or a red light where you had to bring it to a complete stop, but the regen paddles will bring it down to about a mile an hour.
Like downshifting almost, right?
I really liked it.
So. I haven't driven it yet, but it sure is pretty.
Yeah.
So I remember somebody asked last week, and we didn't talk about this, but it was the ELR, and they made mention of the fact of how pathetic the sales are.
Right.
And so
it's very expensive.
Through May, they sold 293 ELRs.
Yeah, so and it's like a little over 50 a month.
It's, last month it was 52 cars. And, you know, I got to say, I think it's a wonderful car. I mean, as you pointed out, the way it looks, the inside, I mean, it's so well done. And, you know, I go back to that should have been the Volt. That should have been the original car. And it could have that price tag. And they would say, we've got technology that's wizard technology. And, you know, you got to pay through the nose for it. But, damn it, we've got it. But, you know, when I talk to Andrew Smith, who is the head designer at Cadillac, he had told me that, so far as he's concerned, that he believes that the ELR is a car that should be delivered in a jewelry box, that it's just something that is very special. And they feel good about that, having that car mm-hmm. in their lineup to be able to say, look, this is special. You know, you can't buy one of these from anybody else. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and that's good for a brand, I think.
I would agree completely. It's kind of a halo car
right.
for them. Now, it's not necessarily going to appeal to all Cadillac buyers,
right.
but it gives them some credibility that we care about the environment. We've got a plug-in hybrid, and it's a beautiful car. It's a terrific one. One thing I wanted to point out, though, is I think this is on the Volt now, too. There's a setting that you can get to so that it will only run with the engine. Or run in hybrid mode, not pure
right.
EV mode.
Okay.
So it's like you can sort of save your EV charge.
Oh, interesting.
So you can drive through your neighborhood very quietly and cleanly, get out on the road or the freeway, go back to the engine, and then when you get to a friend's place or in some place where you want to be back in EV mode, you put it back in EV. And I love that feature. But what I also found is it made me get lazy. And it was like, I'm not going to plug that thing in tonight. You know, I'm just going to get out and go in the house. Or when I get to work here, oh, man, I'm running late. I'm not going to plug that stupid thing in. And so in my week with the car, I averaged 40 miles to the gallon. Not a bad number.
Right.
For the life of the car, obviously, people who had it before me were more religious about plugging it in. So I think the average over the life of the car was 52 miles per gallon. But I know people who are religious about it.
Well, I was just going to say, you hit it for a week. I mean, if you buy that, you're going to be that type of person that focuses more on that, I would think.
But, you know, when the Volt first came out, the EPA did not want this you don't have to be in EV mode thing. They wanted you to burn up your first 40 miles of EV mode only to force you to plug in. The EPA wants you refueling, quote unquote, refueling the car off the grid, not at the gas station by putting gasoline in it. And so I kind of find this interesting, and I wonder if others are getting to be like me that, you know, hey, I'm going to save my EV charge and not plug it in right now.
It'd be interesting to talk to owners about this. And you could talk to all of them since there's so few of them.
Go over to their houses individually.
Well, you guys both know a guy, a TV anchor here in Detroit, Devin Skilly. And he bought a Volt, and he was religious about it. And I want to say he was averaging 100 miles to the gallon with his Volt.
Right.
But I got to call him and see if he's bought another.
Okay, but you know, you said that the ELR shows that Cadillac cares about the environment. It almost seems to me that the ELR shows that Cadillac cares about the future, and that it isn't an environmental car so much. Nothing struck me about that car as being
green.
No, it just struck me as like, wow, this is really a 21st century car.
It's a tech car.
Right. And that's what it is.
Yeah. Tech no, car. Maybe you're right, Gary. Maybe you're right. That's
and you know, in the green credentials, I mean,
it's secondary.
Like, yeah, it's there, but you know, so what? You know, it's just like, look at this thing. And you know, the headlamps on that car, I mean, they've just really done a fine job.
Speaking of green, we got to get into this. Elon Musk came out and said he's going to open up his patents to anybody who wants to use them. Open source, no charge whatsoever.
So what is he going to be opening up or start building later this summer? Oh, that's right, those giant battery plants. Yeah, I mean, if you read what Elon said, he basically is saying that, gee whiz, there needs to be more electric cars, and therefore Tesla has taken all of the patents from our lobby, and now the lobby is the walls are clean because we've taken them all out, and now everybody can have them. And oh, by the way, we'll still win because we have the more committed and clever engineers. But you know, for the rest of you people, start building electric cars because I'll sell you the batteries.
Because if you use their patents, it's pretty much only their battery that you can use in the
system. That would fit.
Right?
This is just.
How generous.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean,
well, the company has to make money somehow because it's not making money.
So. Right. So that becomes a question. I mean, we've talked about on the show quite a bit. I mean, is his play to sell the car company, or is his play to basically keep the car company going and, oh, by the way, really make his dough off of selling the batteries? Because, I mean, the number of batteries he's talking about, you know, producing out of these gigafactories, I mean, completely
enormous.
Dwarf
yeah.
the number of,
right.
Electric cars that are going to be seen for the foreseeable future.
And it might be a combination of all those things.
Right.
He says, hey, you know, we'll do the electric cars, we'll do the batteries, and yeah, it'll be interesting what his ultimate plan is with that company. So we were talking earlier, too, aluminum. Are we at the tipping point?
Yeah.
Where the industry, because who was, somebody, Ducker Worldwide
yes.
came out with a survey.
85% right? of pickup trucks in the U.S. will have will be all aluminum by 2025. Do we buy it?
I'm not sure. Boy, it's...
Of course, if you think about 85% of the trucks, you know, Ford's got a big chunk of that already, and they're going aluminum, so...
You know, the only reason I have some sort of hesitation is in 2018, there's going to be a review of the
exactly.
CAFE standard.
Yeah.
And if at that time they go, you know, we don't have to push quite as hard as we
right.
thought, then no. But on the other hand, you know, it's really hard to see how you can get a truck to do its part to hit a 54.5 corporate average.
Something pretty radical.
Without some sort of electrification. And, you know, hybrid technology and pickups, the drivability, I'm not sure it's there.
Well,
and
okay.
so you need aluminum to go like
remember,
what?
Toyota and Ford had that deal, and it just kind of,
But, okay, so the Ducker study also, I mean, if we dig a little deeper here, they said in 2015, the amount of aluminum on a pickup truck will be 548.9 pounds, okay? But this is the interesting thing. On e-sedans, they'll be 546.9 pounds. So basically, it is just 2 pounds less than on a pickup truck. So they're seeing...
With an electric car?
No, this is an e-sedan, just a regular car. Oh, the amount of aluminum that's going to be E-class. Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, the study was done, you know, with the Aluminum Association. So yeah. I should point that out.
Yeah. But, full disclosure.
Okay, mm-hmm. But I was at a supplier yesterday, Magna, which is, I mean, they not only build every conceivable component you can think of, they also build cars. I mean, they have the Magna Steyr plant in Graz, Austria, and are building Mercedes and things like that for them. And they had, because they were involved in the DOE study with Ford, this mixed material vehicle that is based on a Ford Fusion. And so Magna is, you know, among other things, a manufacturing company. And the reason they got involved in this was because they wanted to see whether they could do productionized mixed material systems. Okay, so this is it's an aluminum intensive vehicle. Okay, and in their case, sort of counter to what we heard earlier about, well, you've got this existing car, you don't want to change things. What they basically did was they tore apart a Fusion and reconstructed it using alternative materials. Now, they're only going to build 7 of them, so it's not like they're going to sell them to anybody. But you talk to these guys, and they're convinced that going forward, it's going to be aluminum. There's
wow.
There's no question. And,
wow.
And, you know, so they're working out the production processes. So, I mean, because we've long known that, you know, stamping steel and welding it together is, you know, 60 jobs per hour, nothing doing right. And so these guys are just working it out. So this is going to be basically a wash. And, you know, you have that 30% weight differential. So even if they change in 2018, realize you still got the European Union in 2020. So, I mean, that regulation is going to exist. So I don't think that, you know, if you're Mercedes or BMW, you're going to say, well, we'll build cars for America and we'll build cars for Europe.
No. Yeah, that doesn't
so,
work.
No. So I think aluminum is going to be a real game changer.
Well, now the question is, will the aluminum industry be able to ramp up production fast enough to meet what automotive needs?
Right.
Because I remember talking to, was it Alcoa, I think, and they said, get in line. Because
right.
Ford just done bought up all the excess capacity for the next 3
right.
years.
Right.
Well, you know, you've got Novelis and a number of other companies that you know, can fill in the blanks here.
Well, but Ford has a deal with them, too, though, right?
Right. I'm sure that all of these people are working out deals mm-hmm. with everyone. And so
prices are going up of aluminum now because everyone's trying to buy it.
Right. Buy aluminum.
Right.
It's not plastics.
Yeah,
it's aluminum.
But you got to believe that, you know, the steel companies are going to fight back. I mean, they're doing it now. I mean, with these ultra high strength steels, and you know, the interesting thing about that is that those steels don't process the same way exactly as, you know, your you know, standard cold rolled steels, you know, your mild steels. So there's some difference there. So then the question becomes, okay, you know, do you go for the sexy one, which, you know, arguably now it's more sexy to go to aluminum mm-hmm. than to even an ultra high strength steel. So let's see what happens there. But it could be. I mean,
it could be the tipping point.
Yeah.
Well, I'm very interested in what the Magna guys were telling mm-hmm. you. Because
they have a lot at stake, so.
Well, not only that, but as you pointed out, Michelle, the Ducker study was underwritten by mm-hmm. the aluminum producers. Not that I don't trust Ducker to do it right, mm-hmm. but when Magna says, boy, we see you going this way, they're plugged into so many automakers.
Oh, yeah.
They know what's coming down
the pipe. And you know, and don't get me wrong. I mean, they're more than willing to make all the steel parts that people mm-hmm. want, the aluminum parts. They, you know, they're doing magnesium parts. They're doing composite developments. I mean, it's astonishing what these guys are doing. I mean, I was really blown away. Huh. And but, you know, it just seemed that, you know, especially with this Ford project car that they had there, that they're really, really thinking that this is the way it's going to be going.
Okay, we've all agreed that we're going to do a little bit different kind of a show today.
Okay.
And we're going to do a rapid fire amongst each other where we fire questions at each other, not from the audience or to a guest, but to each other. So why don't we get into that? But before we do, Ben, we're going to go to rapid fire, so you got to let it rip. Okay, Gary.
Why don't we have to have a short answer, right?
Yeah, short
right.
answer.
Short question, short answer.
Yes.
No, you got to ask a question.
Oh, I get to ask a question.
Yeah,
okay.
All right.
So an appeals court in New York City gave New York and Nissan the green light for the NV200 Taxi of Tomorrow fleet. Good idea?
You know, I haven't studied that one so much, so why not?
No, I don't think so. I think that the taxi fleets best know what's good for them, and they shouldn't have some city to department mandating the kind of vehicle that they should buy.
Okay.
Go ahead, Michelle.
Okay.
You got one?
Chrysler announced they appointed some Alfa Romeo dealers this week. Will Alfa succeed in the U.S.?
Oh, boy, that's a
good
question. How do you define success?
Yeah.
But they were basically all Fiat dealers, because, I mean, I looked at the list.
But will they sell?
So I'm sure if
I was... How will Alfa do in the U.S.?
I'm sure they'll sell all the 4Cs that they want.
Yeah, I think Alfa is going to struggle in the U.S. market. I think they're going to have a very difficult time. I think the goal is to sell 200,000 cars worldwide in just a few years' time. I don't think they're going to hit that.
Well, and Fiat's actually struggling here. They don't sell that many cars either. So.
Yeah, but they need something else in that dealership,
right? Well, true, but...
They got that 500 and that.
Yeah, well...
Okay, I got a question for you guys. Joe Hendricks, the chief... No, he's running North America, mm-hmm. right, for Ford.
Mm-hmm.
He's only
Mark Fields' old job.
5 years, I'm not even sure, 5 years younger than Mark Fields, who's now the CEO. Both very ambitious executives, both hard chargers, both really good. My question to you guys is, will Joe Hendricks wait around to ultimately get the CEO job if he's only 5 years younger than Mark?
And by the way, he's not got the reputation for being very patient.
Yeah.
So
you guys are saying no.
But where would he go?
I don't know. I'm sure he could be picked up in a heartbeat.
Well, yeah, but I mean, what job would he want?
A CEO job at a car company.
At a car company, but...
Yeah. So my guess is they'll throw enough money at Joe to keep him here, and Mark will retire before he hits 65 to give Joe enough time to be CEO.
If he sticks around.
If he sticks around. Okay, Gary, I don't see it.
I think you're spinning a story here. All right, Jaguar Land Rover, which is owned by Indian company Tata, mm-hmm. plans to build an engine plant in China, okay, near Shanghai, where it has a building of production, an assembly plant. Why don't they build engines in India?
Well, I would think that it makes more sense to build them in China where they're going to sell, right?
Well, I would say cost and quality. You know, the supply chain in India is not known for its quality and untimeliness and that sort of thing. Probably doesn't hurt them to have some sort of local content.
That's what I'm thinking, yeah.
You still have to pay an import tax if you import cars to China. Are they building them there?
They're going to build the Range Rover Evoque and larger Jaguar models.
Well, that makes
and
sense.
they have Chery as their joint venture partner.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, I just wonder why if you're an Indian owned company, right? The only other engine plants they have are in the UK, so you know, build them where you sell them. Well, they sell a lot of them here. And there's no engine plant here.
Well,
I'm sure
no
they're going to
assembly plant either. Though.
Right, but they're going to sell more in China. I mean, I get that.
Mm-hmm. I think it's about the money. I mean, it's probably cheaper to build them there without paying an import duty. That import duties are very high.
So I just wonder why India seems to be lagging in terms of automotive.
Well, the
production.
Market's in China too. They're selling more luxury cars. They're hot there.
Okay, Michelle.
Okay, Hyundai sold its first fuel cell Tucson. Are fuel cells finally here?
No, not at all. This is a California ZEV credits ploy that Toyota is soon going to follow suit. Honda's been there for a while. Everybody else is looking at, but no, fuel cells will not catch on, not anytime soon.
I think that what it represents is the beginning of more multi-powertrain vehicles will there be tens or hundreds of thousands of these things rolling around? Probably not. But will people have the opportunity to say, hey, I want to get one of those with a...
They live in the right place near a station.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and they'll and that's what I think is happening.
Yeah. I agree.
Okay. Is it my turn?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm gonna spin my question. I was going to ask a little bit differently and add fuel cell cars, because I was originally going to ask, will EVs ever provide a return on investment for any car company before this decade is out?
Tesla.
They're not making money.
No, they'll make it off the batteries. That's why Elon gave his pens away today.
Okay. We'll see if he does. You think any car company will make money off the money they've invested in making electric cars or fuel cells before this decade is out?
I don't think so.
Okay. I don't either. Okay.
All right. Great. So the Seoul, speaking of EVs, the Seoul EV went into production in Korea. The annual output is expected to be 5,000 vehicles. It'll be sold both in Europe and in the United States. Will they need that many?
Well, I don't. This goes back to what I just said before. This is all about California ZEV credits, and will that be enough ZEV credits? And I don't know how the European CO2 scheme works. Whether selling EVs helps, it must help lower your overall.
Right, because it's a fleet average.
But they must be heavily, heavily weighted towards EVs for so few numbers to offset the other vehicles they sell. 5,000 a year is nothing.
Well,
and that goes back to my question. Anyone ever going to make money off this?
Right.
They're
and
never going to make money off
R&D that's
5,000 a year. No way.
Yeah. Where's all
not at Seoul prices.
Yeah.
Michelle, you got another one?
Highly skeptical. But, you know, I just think that EVs like fuel cells are this tiny little niche in the market. I don't unless there's some amazing breakthrough in cost and range and technology. They're not going to be much more than a niche for a long time.
Okay, I've got another one here. Enthusiasts hate CVTs, but CVTs deliver fantastic real-world fuel economy. So with a 54.5 mile per gallon CAFE looming out there in the future, will CVTs become the choice of car makers by 2025?
Ooh, 2025? That's 10 years from now.
Well, they're the choice of Nissan right now. Okay,
yeah.
So basically, right across the board, you're going to buy a Nissan.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so...
But Audi's had them and not
right. Audi dropped them, but
and
Honda just came out with its own, mm-hmm. not purchased, its own.
Well, but if you remember, they had their own, I want to say 10 years ago, maybe more than 10 years ago, and they had it in a Civic that they were actually building themselves, and then that went away. Okay, but see... Your question said, enthusiasts don't like CVTs. In 2025, will there be the choice? In 2025, won't the enthusiasts sort of be like this small group of people that are being beaten down by all these...
They're a tiny niche already.
Yeah, this is like by all these environmentalists.
Three times the niche that the environmental cars are.
But see, the thing is, but there'll be no choice by 2025. Okay,
mm-hmm.
so the enthusiasts will be, you know, outnumbered, is all I'm saying. I've gone too long on my answer.
We'll see. Anybody else got another one?
All right, so in the New York Times this past weekend, there was a piece by this guy named Adam Frank, who's a physicist and astronomer. He's 51 years old. And basically he said when he was a kid, and this was the case for all three of us, I believe, he was promised flying cars by now.
I'm totally with
that's why
okay.
I brought up flying
that's
cars.
That's what I was thinking about. You were stepping on my question, damn it.
Because I read that story.
Okay, so now he gave because he's a physicist, he gave it his answer, which had to do with the four universal forces of, you know, the strong and weak forces, gravity and electromagnetism. And he just basically said that, you know, we mere humans are only okay with electromagnetism and we can't do anything about gravity. Okay, so he's basically saying, no flying cars. So my question to you two is, will we have flying cars sometime before we work at Space Lease Rockets with George Jetson?
Oh, I shudder to think of people.
Before we have what of?
We have jobs at Space Lease Rockets with, that's where George Jetson worked. He had a flying car.
I shudder to think of people flying their cars they're bad at driving them on the roads.
They'll be autonomous anyway.
Well,
I've always said that one day we're going to wake up and learn how to harness gravity. It's everywhere. It's 24/7. And we're going to go, oh, no, it's a constant force. One of these days, we're going to learn how to harness gravity.
I don't think it's
going to
be my lifetime.
That's going to be our fuel. No, it's not.
And I'm old.
And if we do that, we won't need cars.
Sure. No, right. We still need to get around.
No, we would just get around.
We'd fly like
just
our
be
dreams.
Like Superman.
Well, yeah. Look, popular science had flying cars on its
in
cover.
1957
no,
or something
30s.
Like the 30s?
They had it in the 30s. And that's what I've been saying. You know, come on already. I want a flying car. And I don't want something with wings or anything like mm-hmm. that and a propeller or a jet. I just want it to hover and take off.
So, but we have to wait for that anti-grav.
We do, yeah. I don't care what physics says. It's going to happen. Okay, no more questions?
No,
good.
Do we have some from listeners, viewers?
Yeah, let's see if we got any. No, it was all with the okay. Camaro ones.
Well, a question I got a lot this week was, I guess Lincoln did its drive of the MKC.
Yeah.
Anybody thinking about how that will do?
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, we talked a little bit about this last week. I'm impressed by the MKC. Mm-hmm. I think it's a credible competitor to other cars in its class. Now, does that mean that people are going to say, I don't want this Mercedes or BMW? No, no.
No.
It's not going to pull people out of other luxury brands.
And one of the people who had a comment on Autoline Daily about the MKC, John and I were on the drive program together mm-hmm. last week,
oh, okay.
so we both drove the car, and I thought that this person made a very pertinent point, saying, okay, that car is basically a $50,000 car, and you can get an RDX pretty much loaded for 40. Will people pay an extra 10 grand for the Lincoln?
Hmm.
What do you, I mean?
I don't know. I thought it was less than that.
Well,
the
base
30,
price
30?
Is about 36, I want to say.
Yeah, and the all-wheel, so the all-wheel drive version, mm-hmm. which is, you know, that's when you begin stepping it up.
Okay,
and then when you
get,
and this isn't even the, so that was the reserve package.
That's
and then there's going to be something on top of reserve.
Yeah.
Black Label,
Black
I think.
Label, yes, mm-hmm. yes.
Is that the name of a beer? Carling's?
No, I thought it was a whiskey.
Whiskey.
Johnny Walker, Black
Carling's
Label.
Black Label. Mm-hmm.
There was a Carling's Black Label. You're right.
Yeah.
Wow.
You drink the expensive stuff, huh?
Yeah. I don't think they make it anymore.
I'm sure they
probably
don't.
Drink it fresh, too. Oh, okay. So Westride just shot in a question that fits the rapid-fire format. By 2020, fully autonomous cars everywhere?
Oh, not everywhere. But I think they'll be here.
What does everywhere mean?
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
Will the three of us have them?
Yeah.
Well, I think I agree with what you're saying is that, you know,
they'll
be around. I mean, and so I watched, so when Google made their announcement about their fully autonomous car, they did it at this conference that was put on by this Recode, which was started by two people who had been with Wall Street Journal, Walt Mossberg and Kara Swisher. And so they interviewed Sergey Brin, and I watched the entire interview today, God knows why. And, you know, his point was rather interesting. I mean, he was looking at it from the point of view, he's saying that, you know, he lives in Silicon Valley, he saw a woman who was going to a bus stop, she, you know, older woman carrying groceries, and she just missed the bus. And he was making the point in Silicon Valley that bus service ain't great because, you know, most of those people are driving Teslas. And he's saying, you know, what a horrible thing. And wouldn't it be nice if there were, you know, a way that mm-hmm. she'd be able to get around, and if the Google car were there, that it would be a good thing. And so, you know, let's not forget that Google owns a big piece of Uber.
That was another one of my...
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And you know, that's basically a call up, and the car will come
on
and get
app,
you, right?
Yes.
And so, and he was basically saying, this is how the whole thing would work, that you'd have an app on your phone for these autonomous cars. Because, I mean, because there's no steering wheel, no brake, no anything. There's a start-stop button, and that's it. So you'd have to put in, like, or tell it, you know, go to my house, I live, such and such, and then it will take you there. So, You know, you're going to mention that Uber strike yesterday in Europe.
Yes. You know.
Unbelievable.
Because they're huge.
The taxi drivers in Europe don't like Uber.
Not at all.
Where was this, Paris and London?
It was from London to Berlin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, and it was just massive chaos. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just the, I mean, it was just all these. It was
clearly a disruptive force in the marketplace.
Right. Yeah, I mean, even the cab drivers in Spain went on strike, and Uber isn't even in Spain. I mean, it's just.
Well, it's a threat to them.
But sure.
I'd say try to stop it, guys.
Right.
Go ahead.
Right.
Be my guest. It's like the hotel industry is all up in arms, especially in Europe. Because of this peer-to-peer kind of bookings that you can do for homes and apartments.
Well, New York City's upset about
Airbnb.
That.
Yeah.
Crash out on somebody's couch, and you know it's sort of a Craigslist kind of a thing that you can go or other websites to do it. And I say, I can understand why you're against it. Try to stop it.
Right. Right.
Okay. Why don't we wrap up?
Okay.
And before we go, though, I got a couple of things that I should mention here. I want to remind everybody, we're talking a lot about Chevrolet.
And we're talking about them again.
And on our television show, Outline This Week, which is available on our website right now, you can go watch Tim Mahoney, the chief marketing officer for Chevrolet's global branding.
Right.
Not necessarily in the U.S., but all around the world. Michelle's actually on that show, too. Pretty good discussion of where Tim Mahoney wants to take the Chevrolet brand and thinking about it on a global basis, not just hot dogs, baseball, apple pie, and Chevrolet, but, you know.
Football.
How it resonates in China and India and other places like that, too. So make sure you check that out. It's pretty good. But, Michelle, thanks so much for coming
on.
Oh,
thank you
for having me. Great having you here. And
congratulations on the new job.
Thanks. It's great.
And Gary?
John?
Let's do it again next week.
Be a good idea.
Yeah.
Okay. See you then.
I want to thank everybody for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.